Joining me today is a very, very special guest. He's a true legend in the music industry whose career has spanned over six decades, Engelbert. That's a while. He's captivated audiences worldwide with amazingly big hits. And wow, the list, if I spent the time reading all the accolades, Engelbert, we'd be here for half of the interview. Engelbert Humperdinck, welcome. It is great to have you chatting to us today. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you, Ian. I'm very well. It's a lovely day here in California.
Fantastic. I'm a little bit jealous. It's winter. Oh, yeah. It's winter down south. You do realize you're going to have to don a jersey when you get here.
I can't believe it. I always thought it was warm. It was all the time over there.
Well,
I've been many times. I've been before, but you know, I think I must have come in the summertime.
Yeah, most probably you did. Engelbert, yeah. You started your career, as I did in the intro, in the late 1950s under the name Jerry Dorsey. How many times have you been asked this question? But for those people who don't really know the history, you teamed up with Gordon Mills, and he, of course, working with the likes of Tom Jones, etc. And you ended up changing to Engelbert Humperdinck as your stage name. How did that all come about?
Well, it was, you know, Gordon Mills was the brains behind the change because when we first signed up, I was under the name of Jerry Dorsey, and I wrote a song called Stay, and he took it to Decca Records, and he said that here's a guy that's going to be, you know, as big as Tom Jones, and they said, Jerry Dorsey? Oh, no, he's old hat. That's because I'd already been, a semi-name in the UK. And I had tuberculosis, and I was off for a couple of years, and nobody wanted to take the chance of taking me back again. So he changed my name to Engelbert Humperdinck, took the song back, and they signed me up.
Wow, what a story.
Yeah.
Was your collaboration with Gordon Mills was obviously a pivotal point in your career, changing the trajectory completely. Give us a taste of what that was like. What did he do for your career?
Well, what he did was... not only changing my name, but you know, he found the song "Release Me," and we played it together. And I listened to it. I loved the melody, and I said, Gordon, I think this is the song that's going to be the big thing for me. And we recorded it, and it was it stood on the shelf for about 3 months until I did a television show called "The Sunday Night of the London Palladium," and then it flew off the shelf. Selling 80,000, 90,000, 127,000 a day.
Wow. That must have been absolutely crazy for you to realize that you were suddenly finding that success.
It was the early years when success came along was pretty hectic. I was doing somewhere in the region about 300 shows a year, and I had barely a little time just, you know, for my home life. And it was very difficult, but in order to build a career, you had to go through these stages of your life, you know?
Let's move forward just a tad then to the 1970s, really. I'd like to talk about a song, After the Lovin', which was a big hit for yours in the 70s. How did your sound, I mean, you've got to now follow it up with a bigger song and something that is equally as impressive. How did that evolve in your career?
Well, a friend of mine called Joe Diamond, brought the song to me. He's a producer in Los Angeles, and he was in New York at the time. And he brought the song to me, and I said, God, that's a hit song. So we took the song and played it to Gordon, and Gordon listened to it. He says, okay, let's record it. And I said, this is going to be another Release Me. I just smelled it. I just smelled it as a great hit, you know. And we recorded it, and the arranger was Charlie Colello, who's a brilliant arranger. Did a lot of music for the Four, Frankie Valli, and all those people, you know. And he did arrangements for them, and he did this particular arrangement, and it was the most highly played song in 1977 on radio, the most played song, wow, actually, in 1977. And it was a great stepping stone in my career.
Yeah.
It was 10 years after Release Me, and it just jumped my career up quite a bit.
I guess having big hits like that, the pressure's always on to then come up with something else. And from that song, as you mentioned, in 1977, let's spool right forward to 1996. I've got a kind of a wry grin on my face here when you recorded Lesbian Seagull for the Beavis and Butthead Do America soundtrack. I mean, from the yeah. sublime to the rather ridiculous, Engelbert.
I know, but... The people who making that movie, Beavis and Butthead, came to see me at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles, and they enjoyed my sense of humor on stage, and of course they liked my voice, and so they came backstage and asked me if I would do this song for Beavis and Butthead. I said, send me the song, I'll listen to it, and we'll have a go at it. Mm. So I heard it, I thought it had a great future because it was different and it's something I've never done before. So I'm always a challenging person. I love a challenge, you know. And I took this on and bingo, it was went platinum, you know.
Amazing. Engelbert, your 2014 album, Engelbert Calling, has a whole bunch of duets on it. You've alluded to the fact that you've worked with some greats in your time. Tell us a little bit about some collaborations that you've done, especially on that album. What draws you to people to perform with them in studio and then, I guess, subsequently on stage? What's the magic that you look for?
Well, the magic is being able to record with such artists, you know, and that's magic in itself. And then... I recorded in the studio with some of them live, but most of them, you know, it's a little difficult for them to travel distances yeah. to come and record with me, so, or me travel to them. Hmm. So therefore it's done, I do my part, they do their part. But there's a couple of them that did it in the studio with me in Los Angeles, and people like Elton John and Gene Simmons. Those were a couple of the artists that I worked with over here. And it was a pleasure to do work with, you know, the great Kenny Rogers, God rest his soul. You know, he was a wonderful man. I've worked and working with Johnny Mathis and Neil Sedaka and Dionne Warwick and, you know, people like that.
That's just...
It's just an amazing... experience.
I'm sure it was, and I'm sure it was for them too, with your great voice and great talent, having spanned so many decades by that time. Anyway, I'd like to talk as well. Obviously, with the UK as your home base, the Eurovision Song Contest in 2012 gave you the opportunity to get up on stage and represent the UK. Tell us about that. What was that? What did that mean to you? Must have been quite a big honor.
I mean, I enjoyed the fact that I was representing my country, and the song was good, you know, had good quality and had a good standing. But I'm afraid it's a political thing over there, which happens to destroy some of the great songs that come along. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that was a good song, and then they put on a person like myself who's been a known artist and traveled around the world several times with 65 gold and 23 platinums. And there were some people there without even a record contract that were up in the top three, it's a difficult situation, very political.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting take on it. I would have thought that that you would have absolutely relished the fact, but the fact that there is a political spin to it obviously tainted it for you a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I loved it. I loved it because, you know, people around the world saw you walk on stage and sing a song, which is fine. The publicity was unbelievable.
Of course.
I mean, and the fact that I didn't make it, at the top, it didn't matter. It didn't matter to me. The fact that people saw me, but the bad part about it is I didn't win.
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely.
But,
sure. Engelbert, I have to say that one of the first introductions as a youngster to your music was a remix and a dancey kind of remix of Cuando Cuando, which was just, it stood out for me because there was this magnificent voice of yours and it had this catchy beat to it. And I remember listening to this going, what? What is this song? Of course, not knowing your history, I was too young. But it kind of leads me to my next question to say, You are so diverse in the amount of music that you, or the different types of music that you record. Gospel, yeah. Dance music is there. Of course, your traditional kind of standards. Do you pursue anything that kind of catches your imagination, or are you quite scientific about it?
No, actually, when Cuando came along, I knew that that was going to be part of my repertoire. And, you know, the fact that the lyric was written by, it's an Italian song, and the lyric was written by Pat Boone, whom actually happens to be a friend of mine.
Oh, wow.
And now, a friend of mine now, but I didn't know him then. He wrote the lyric, and I kept it in my show. It wasn't a hit for me, a big hit, but it was a well-known song.
Yes.
So therefore, I kept it in my show. As a matter of fact, it's in my show today. You know, and because it has such great quality.
Yeah.
And it was used in a series called Umbrella Academy quite recently, and in a few movies. So therefore, you know, it has great standing because people want to use it all the time.
Absolutely. In recent years, I'm talking quite recently now, let's go to the movies for a second once again. Marvel's Moon Knight series, you had A Man Without Love. You've alluded to the fact that, you know, publicity is always good. And if you can get on a movie, of course, that boosts that song. Do you find that you reach new audiences, new young faces, new ears are coming to your concerts just because they're associating you with movies?
I'm going to tell you something, my friend. When that song came out on that series, it went, after me recording it about 50-something years ago, it went back into the Spotify charts at number one.
Wow.
And, of course, the young people watched the show, Moon Knight, and I was seeing new faces in the audience because these young people wanted to come and see what an Engelbert Humperdinck was all about.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it was lovely to see new faces. And when I sang that song, they just went berserk. And I thought it was fantastic. And so that song also is in my show.
Amazing. Amazing, Engelbert. Just a couple more for you, and then we'll wrap up. I want to know from you about what you think, looking back retrospectively now, some of your greatest moments are. Who? Maybe it's someone you've performed with. Maybe it's a particular show. Maybe it's a time in your life. Looking back now, does something really stand out over all these years?
I've had many standout appearances, I think, in my life. You know, the fact that... I played one venue. It was 250,000 people. That's like an amazing amount of people to watch.
Wow!
In an audience, and actually that was when I was in New Zealand, and they love the song Ten Guitars over there because it's like their second national anthem.
Right.
And when I performed it over there, I had to do it three times. Once for me, once for the audience, and just once for good luck. You know.
Wow. So, wow, yeah. That's amazing. 250,000
the audience, they sing it from the age of 3 years old and the kids start singing Ten Guitars.
Fantastic.
It's a barbecue song, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely. If you can attach a memory to a piece of music, I guess you've got it made, really, Engelbert, haven't you?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Engelbert Humperdinck, what an absolute pleasure to catch up with you. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you very much indeed. God bless you.